It's 3:06 on Friday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. With me today, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You see him in the Thursday and Sunday paper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Hello, Metro Atlanta.
And state of Georgia. Loretta Lepore, she is a Republican insider. She's worked as a strategist in any number of campaigns. Most recently, she was the Georgia co-chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign. Never heard anything about the Russians trying to interfere with Carly Fiorina's campaign.
That would be a dangerous boundary to cross.
Greg Bluestein, political reporter from the AJC, is here today. We needed Greg here because, like Galloway, he's been spending his time down at the Capitol and can help us break down what happened at the in the final hours of the legislature.
But he's way too much time.
He's younger and he's got more energy.
Yeah,
not today.
And David Dennis, who's an adjunct journalism professor at Morehouse College, joins us for the first time.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
He's not packing.
We'll do the initiation. The hazing comes after the show.
Okay, great.
For your first appearance here, we should point out very quickly that Galloway and Bluestein are ready to. They've slept for like 3 hours total between them. So we got so much to talk about today. Let's start with a few of the headlines. The I-85 fire that's completely shut down I-85 and the Buford Connector has become politicized, no surprise. Among other things, John Eaves, who is running for mayor and, of course, is the current Fulton County chairman, sent out an email to his supporters really early this morning.
2:35.
Yeah, saying the traffic crisis is the result of the, quote, lack of a cohesive and comprehensive transportation plan. But then he went on to say, and this is a real shot across Kasim Reed's bow, we need leaders who roll up their sleeves to develop robust public policy, not people who roll up to the scene when the cameras are rolling. The other mayoral candidates all focused their tweets on the good job that police and fire did. University of Virginia political scientist Larry Sabato has changed his projection in the Georgia 6th district race from likely Republican to toss-up. I think everybody at this table thinks that's overly optimistic. We'll talk about that. Sonny Perdue's nomination to become Secretary of Agriculture is headed to the floor of the Senate. He passed unanimously out of committee. The question now becomes whether they'll take up his nomination and confirm him next week, or will they wait 2 weeks? They got a two-week break before Sonny Perdue finally gets. By the time Sonny actually gets confirmed, Trump will be running for re-election at this rate. And finally, and this is really interesting news, it's a follow-up to questions an awful lot of people have been asking after the failure of the GOP health care plan. Will the Trump administration do its best to keep ACA, the Obamacare, propped up? Senior House Republicans have said that they expect the federal government will continue paying billions of dollars in subsidies to health insurance companies to keep low-income people covered under the Affordable Care Act for the rest of this year and perhaps into 2018. That's significant because Tom Price, our own Tom Price, in hearings the other day, refused to say exactly how the administration was going to deal with
Obamacare. He was very obtuse about that.
Jim, let's start because of the politics. You've got a column coming up on Sunday that you've been working on. Tell us how you see this bridge collapse and the paralyzation of how we're paralyzed by it fitting into.
We've got a new slogan for Metro Atlanta. It's if I can get there from here. Seriously. We were talking earlier, you mentioned John Eaves, the mayoral candidate in Atlanta and the shots he was taking. But this is really not a city of Atlanta issue. I mean, interstates are not city property. They're a federal, regional, state concern. And I think this really affects the 6th district race. That's the quadrant of Metro Atlanta that's just most immediately and directly impacted by the collapse of I-85.
Okay, but so while we understand, the feds have already, we've already gotten word from Washington that they are going to step up and they will pay and they, for and, emergency
right, and they
repairs.
Will fix, they will fix, help fix the bridge, and it will still take two or three months. But the larger topic is finding alternative pathways.
Right.
Because right now what we have is, thank goodness, the North Marta line was not damaged in that fire. Because that's now this little slender economic thread that connects downtown Atlanta to Gwinnett, to Roswell, and it really fits into the larger Metro Atlanta discussion of the place of commuter rail.
Well, there are a lot of Atlantans right now who are suburbanites, I should say, who are dusting off those MARTA cards, thinking for the first time in a long time they're going to be going back to MARTA for something other than going to the airport or going to a sports event.
We're going to have to watch and see how this develops, but the fact of the matter is, it's telling, isn't it, Loretta, that the feds immediately, I mean very quickly, said we're going to step in and help. And the reason I suggest it's telling is you've got a Republican governor who eventually came around, supported Donald Trump. You've got to wonder if the Trump White House said to DOT, federal DOT, get on this right away, let's make a statement, even though the president himself didn't intervene.
Well, this is catastrophic in a lot of respects, that it's hit a major urban center, and it's the responsibility of the federal government to respond in situations like this once a state of emergency is declared.
So you don't think that this was a favor? Not that they weren't going to eventually respond, but that they did it so quickly.
No, and I thought the governor and GEMA were very expeditious in the way that they reached out to the federal government, declared a state of emergency, and called in for reinforcements in this regard, because it is their jurisdiction.
Yeah, I think it was just a recognition of what a devastating economic impact this is going to have, not just on Atlanta but on the region, on the
right.
South as a whole.
And as it's being broadcast repeatedly, I mean, the fire it was, you know, broadcast, went virtual, around the country, and even as you're conducting business today, people are asking about it. That's the first thing they ask about. You know, are you caught in traffic? You know, did you make it to your meeting today? And they say it kind of lightheartedly, but they know that we have a situation with our transportation already as it is.
Did you wake up worrying about that this morning, Dave?
Yeah, a little bit. I was sort of concerned.
Even though you live out west.
Yeah, I live out west, but I was like, you know, I don't know. You're trying to check the path to see about coming to this interview and seeing how long it would take. But, you know, I think the optics on a national scale, when you look at Atlanta and the transportation, we have two issues. There was there's a burning bridge, and then there's, like, burning cars when there's 2 inches of ice 3 years ago. That's what people remember about the city. And there's this, you know, idea about the infrastructure and about the traffic of the city that – you know, I don't know if I want to go or visit Atlanta when, you know, dealing with this.
Yeah. And this time the ice won't melt, as Jim wrote. This time there is no melting of ice. This time the gridlock is here to stay.
So I can't. So you were going to see how the finger gets pointed here, but it does turn out it was GDOT's, I think, equipment. They had PVC piping and stuff that was stored along underneath this overpass.
That's what the governor said. There's no determined cause of this fire yet, but the governor said that he had heard that there was PVC piping that was being stored. It was non-combustible PVC piping. It was meant
apparently
to,
not.
But a fire surgeon said even non-combustible, if it gets hot enough, can combust, I guess. And that looks like that was the cause of the fire, even though it's not been 100% determined.
Well, the fire chief did say that, you know, there was fuel under there. I live about a quarter of a mile from this site. And we see these DOT trucks, they park them there. There's a storage lot there for DOT vehicles. There's a lot of DOT equipment near there. It's also extraordinarily close to the MARTA line in the MARTA backyard. So it really is miraculous that nobody was hurt in this instance and that there wasn't more catastrophic damage to property. And I would join in the chorus of folks who are lauding the fire department and our first responders in this instance, because they were quite remarkable in getting a handle on this.
Yeah, we should point out one last thing before we move on. Jim, I think you noticed this. Robbie Ash, the chairman of the MARTA board. I mean, we all know that MARTA expected to have a big increase in traffic, and it'll be interesting to see reports on that by the end of the day today. Robbie Ash tweeted out, I think it was, a photograph of a train in India, one of those photographs that you sometimes see of so many people just hanging off the train.
A locomotive dripping with human beings. Yes.
Suggesting that's what MARTA was going to look like. People are tweeting us about this, and you should join in at PoliticsGPB as we move through the show today. Thought Crime, who tweets at Raw Dog Buffalo, says, great job, such professionalism, a hat tip to the Atlanta Fire and Rescue. So let's move on and talk about some of the other big stories we're covering. Jim and Greg, I'm going to turn to you next. We finished up well after midnight last night at the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to leave it to you. What do you want to start with, the stuff that worked or the stuff that didn't work? Should we go positive or negative?
We can start positive. I don't know if it's positive.
I guess that's right. Positive or negative is really not what
Now, to be fair, usually what we obsess over is what was the issue that shut the place down?
Well, the issue that shut the place down, I think I'm right to say, was campus carry. Is that right?
No.
Texas?
No, it was the adoption bill.
Oh, okay. Well, that is a good place to start, because there was a measure that many people, the governor, we've talked about this on the show, many leaders in the legislature, it's the first opportunity in more than two decades to pass a clean update to Georgia's adoption.
And you know
statutes.
Why they waited so long to do it? Because they were so afraid that someone in the legislature would try to prevent gay and lesbian couples from adopting children.
And that's exactly what happened, right? But amendment was attached.
But the shocking thing is everyone in the Capitol knew this was going to happen in December. I mean, at the Athens Biennial, the training session for new lawmakers in December, there was talk about, Senate leaders, David Schaefer and other Senate leaders are going to tack on this amendment that would ban private or restrict private adoption agencies that receive state money from placing children in the care of same-sex couples.
More specifically, it would offer legal protection to those child placement agencies.
Mm-hmm. What's particularly interesting about this is we've talked throughout the session on this show about the fact that this was not another year where religious liberty became one of the major issues in the session, and yet bill made it that way. Yes, David?
Yeah. I mean, this is just, how things work. It's about, determining what other people do with their private lives, and that's something that it's become legislation du jour, especially in the last, 4 months or so.
Loretta?
I think taking one step back, I thought that it was, I think it's highly unfortunate for the children of our state, right? The children that need homes. And so this was a loss in that regard. And I know that the governor has extreme frustration, has expressed frustration throughout this process, because that legislation has been worked on for a considerably long amount of time.
There are far more children that need to be adopted than families that are available. And so when you decide you're going to shut out same-sex couples, you really create a bigger problem.
Right. And you'd prefer to have a child living in a loving home than no home. But I thought that the thing, if you took a step back and you kind of stepped outside of the gold dome, you had this debate going on simultaneously while North Carolina mm-hmm. was working to repeal their bathroom bill, trying to salvage whatever they could of their reputation with the business community there. And, and you get myopic when you get into these sessions and you don't think about the ramifications of what you're doing. Though I know the folks that did want to pass that amendment or did amend the bill had a very intentional purpose, didn't really care what was going on outside the Gold Dome. But there were plenty of people looking at this going on simultaneously.
And essentially what happened was the Senate, the House passed it twice. They passed it first in the original form, and then they tacked it on to another Senate bill and sent it back over to the Senate. The Senate hemmed and hawed until 12:57 when they sent it back to committee, and that was the end of it.
All right, where was Casey Cagle in all this? I mean, where
he was on the podium, but he made a couple crucial rulings that determined the fate of the thing.
But of course, his name wasn't on the bill, but he was a force behind it.
He was behind assuring that the amendment was not stripped out of the... I thought this... help me understand
this. He made a couple rulings that prevented the the House version of the bill from getting through.
All right. I want to move on to another issue, but before I do, I mean, this is the Casey Cagle who we've talked about in preparing to make a run for governor, has presumably moved away from the religious right, more to the center, to make himself more palatable to a broader a range of voters. And now you're saying, though, that he was part of the amendment crowd.
Well, but he also has a caucus full of senators who might also run against him that he has to corral. And it is a very important issue to some of the members of his caucus. He wasn't a vocal supporter of this, but if you ask Speaker Ralston, who was very frustrated in the closing minutes of the session and made his frustrations very vocal, Casey Cagle did not do enough to push this
all
bill
right.
through.
Okay.
And Cagle had his own agenda. I mean, he actually got what he wanted out of the final night of the legislature, and that was an anti-terrorism
yep.
bill.
Yep, which the House was really trying to throttle, and yet he made it work. I thought campus carry went down to the wire. And I think it did. It may not have been the final.
No, it was one of the last ones. Yeah. You're right.
So campus carry passed, and it passed with the provisions that Governor Deal said would make him more likely to sign rather than veto as he did last year. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah. Well, and what they are, I think Greg and David are going to have to Loretta, because I have not seen that bill.
He delivered a hand-delivered, handwritten letter last year to House and Senate leaders saying, this is exactly, I can accept a campus carry provision if it carves out these exceptions. Child care facilities on campus, faculty and administrative offices, judicial hearings, and I think there was also a fourth.
High school, places where high school students come to take classes.
Yes, high school students who are joint enrolled.
Yeah.
And the final bill did not, last year's final bill did not include any of those exemptions.
Right.
The governor vetoed it, very forceful veto. This year, I think the governor made it very clear he was much more receptive to it this year, as long as it included those changes. And the final bill, hashed out around 10 o'clock, I guess, last night, included those changes. So my bet is he will sign this bill into law.
David, you're on a campus every day. How are people at Morehouse feeling about this? The fact that they're now going to have to contend with this, assuming the governor signs this bill.
There's not a lot of sort of discussion about we're concerned about people bringing guns onto our campus. I mean, just the overall idea of this is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard in my life, that people are allowed to bring guns on college campuses. There's, you know, alcohol on college campuses. There's, you know, young, immature kids on campus. There's classrooms. This is absurd. I mean, you look at Arkansas, who just passed or tried to get a bill about bringing guns to sporting events, and they immediately regretted the decision once it passed. I mean, we're going to look at sort of the same thing once this, you know, starts to happen, if he does sign it, and you know, we start to see these incidents, you know, sort of happen.
Have you ever had any incidents with interchanges with students that you thought were a little more volatile, that could be made a little more volatile with a handgun?
I would imagine, you know, like, I mean, you know, I might be inclined to bump up some of those C's to C pluses.
But the higher education community did come out, University System of Regents, college presidents, and even some Republican state senators representing Athens, representing North Fulton, representing North DeKalb, voted against this because they had very important constituencies that were very.
Yeah, but I heard members, a couple members of the Board of Regents say they're much more concerned this year about their funding than anything
else.
But
Bill, I will tell you that it's tradition at the end of every session, the governor comes before each chamber and says what a fine job they did. But he did say something last night that I hadn't heard him say before, or I hadn't heard many other governors say before, and that is that he expressed, he gave a warning to these lawmakers that he was going to levy some vetoes.
And I went back through his vetoes over the last few years. He averaged about 8 vetoes a year his first 5 years. Never did he veto more than 11 bills a year in his first 5 years. Last year, I think it was 16. And this year, I think there might be a little bit more.
You wrote a piece about possible vetoes this year. What do we expect? I mean, what are the most likely candidates for vetoes this year?
That's tough. I mean, some of his vetoes last year were very minor, obscure bills that didn't get much attention. But then after they vetoed, they got plenty of attention. I think that the campus The Sanctuary Campus Bill is something that they're I'm guessing they're going to look at pretty closely.
This is the bill that would allow the state to withhold funding from universities that declared themselves to be sanctuary campuses, although no school in Georgia has yet done that, including Morehouse. Emory kind of toyed with it, so did Agnes Scott, but nothing happened there.
And I think that's a precedent-setting bill for the future that could be of concern. And then there's some tax break bills that got passed very hastily after very quick conference committees.
Man.
There could be issues down the road.
I think that's where you're going to see some vetoes. Well, I think the governor, I mean, he spoke during the session to the U.S. Chamber and the Georgia Chamber had a joint event here. And the governor was pretty clear at that point about, he was asked a specific question about what advice would you give to your successor? And the first thing he said was, keep your fiscal house in order. And he addressed the issue of tax reform. And he then did speak out again about this initiative to lower the income tax rate. And that went back and forth between the chambers with modifications, but never didn't pass, is my understanding. And I think that was set up for a veto for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't tie the executive's hands when it comes to, you know, balancing the budget. And that would have made it really, really tough. But I think there are other tax incentives in there that are just not going to fly with him.
Well, one thing that he won't have to veto is daily fantasy sports contests.
Mm-hmm.
That did not make it across the wire.
Yeah, and neither did repairs for luxury yachts, which disappointed me personally, because I was heading down to a dry dock in Savannah right after the show.
And then you might be pleased, because I think it actually did cross.
It did
pass.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I
pass.
Thought that failed as well.
No,
yeah,
it
okay.
passed.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
So
I'm
we're
so
going
glad
Savannah
you're
after
all here.
This.
Keep me honest.
Cast off. Cast off.
Okay. Loretto, real quick note on all of this. You know, there's nothing that ought to strike fear in the hearts of the people of Georgia, I think, more than quickly passed tax bills at the last minute in the legislature.
And too often that happens, right? And you know, and we've seen in the last couple of years a lot of this Christmas tree building on tax bills as they've tried to move things through the legislature in days 39 and 40. And, you know, you guys will remember that under Governor Perdue, he refused to sign a bill that had multiple tax provisions in it for that reason. And even, you know, vetoed some bills that were, you know, there was nothing necessarily wrong with either piece of the bill, but he told them not to bundle it, and they did it anyway.
All right, we're going to have to move along because we got to get a break in, but just a couple of quick notes. Medical marijuana, the addition of now at least one, if not
six new
conditions,
illnesses.
That's passed. Alan Peake will still have to continue to fight to get production of marijuana in a controlled way, manner here. Another year, that's going nowhere. He's probably going to have to wait till a new governor is elected, I would assume, because Nathan Deal's
possibly
made it clear.
Possibly a new U.S. Attorney General,
there
too.
There you go. the campus rape bill was put off, but that's still there for next year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's still alive because this is the first year of a biennial. Is there any other quick thing before
and the
we...
the Failing Schools Initiative that
passed,
the Plan B, and Governor Deal, of course, will sign that, and that is looked at as a less sweeping alternative, but still a palatable one for conservatives.
All right, I want to just go back briefly to what you said about the terrorist bill that passed, because that was one of great contention between the House and the Senate, Jim. And one of the things that the Senate wanted, that the House resisted, was this notion that there should be public disclosure of people who were arrested, were detained in some way,
who were undocumented.
Yes.
I think I don't know whether they're convicted of felonies or not. But actually, you got the larger debate was over whether the state of Georgia should set up an entirely new structure involving Homeland Security with an official yet to be named at the top of that. One can think of several members of the legislature who would like that job.
Well,
right
also
now.
If I'm Casey Cagle and about to launch a gubernatorial campaign,
wouldn't it be nice to have that appointment? Yeah.
Well, have the appointment and also be able to say I fought to make you safer as lieutenant governor.
Well, and we used to have a director of Homeland Security, Bill Hitchens, who's now a member of the General Assembly.
All right, we're going to have to take a break. We got so much talk. The Trump news, I said it at the start of this show, it comes at us like a fire hose. I don't even know where we're going to begin, but we'll find a place. It's 3:30 on Friday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Do you have kids? Chances are good that you've embarrassed them. Those new dance moves you were practicing when their friends came over, driving them to school in that old car. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and I don't want you to give up your groove, but might I suggest donating that old car to this station? You'll save your kids some embarrassment, and if you upgrade to a newer model, you could be the coolest parents ever. Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Thank you for choosing Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, the largest university in Georgia and one of the largest in the nation. You're listening to Political Rewind. I'm Ellen Reinhart.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Greg Bluestein and Jim Galloway of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are with us. Loretta Lepore, a Republican insider, worked for the Sonny Perdue administration when he was governor. I never mentioned that, but I always should. That was a big job for you, Loretta.
Huge.
And we're joined for the first time today and glad to be joined by David Dennis, an adjunct professor of journalism at Morehouse College. At some point today, David, we have to get your take on Sean Spicer's relationship to the White House press corps.
Oh, that'd be great.
Before we get to the Trump news, it strikes me the one thing that really is worth talking about for a Georgia audience is Johnny Isakson has been at home in the state because he's had two back surgeries in a row, which is just awful for any individual. But they got him to Washington, and they wheeled him into the United States Senate in a wheelchair to cast a vote that has a major impact
right.
on Planned Parenthood.
And Mike Pence walked in with him.
Yeah. So just to set the table, this was a vote to allow state. The Obama administration had set rules which said that states could not withhold funds from organizations like Planned Parenthood, just on the basis of the fact that they did abortions among, but you know, in addition to the other services. And this was a vote to overturn that Obama mandate, right? And they needed Isakson, which is fascinating.
They needed Isakson to create the tie.
Yes,
which
allowed Pence to put him over the top.
Right. Break the tie.
It's the second time, by the way, that the vice president has been called upon to break a tie in the United States Senate, which does not happen very often at all. So
was
twice.
Betsy DeVos the other one?
Yes. The confirmation of Betsy DeVos was the other one. Good, you win the prize.
And I think it was because two female Republican senators had voted with the minority.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Senator Isakson came back to Washington. He also said he would have voted. And this was the first time we actually heard his voice saying this. He would have voted for that failed health care plan last week. Gosh, that was only a week ago. But he also added that he is willing to work with Democrats on whatever the successor plan could be. So,
as long as they don't call it a gang.
Gang, right. Yeah.
No gang of six or eight.
I don't
here.
Blame him, really.
I'm just happy to know that something like back surgeries won't keep, you know, an old white guy from telling women what to do with their bodies. That just makes me feel very great.
Oh, God. David, interesting point. Jim, you just pointed out something to me. ProPublica has just released a story. Let's give it just a second. I know you haven't even had a chance to read it.
Yeah.
And we'll deal with it more on another show.
Right. I'll read you a lead. On the same day, the stockbroker for then Georgia Congressman Tom Price brought him up to $90,000 of stock. Bought him up to $90,000 of stock in six pharmaceutical companies. Price arranged to call a top U.S. health official seeking to scuttle a controversial rule that would have hurt the firm's profits. So the topic of Tom Price's finances is not going to go away.
Yeah, I think, David, that's true. I think that, you know, Tom Price obviously was confirmed, but there is going to be a lot more talk about whether Price, in fact, was acting with conflict of interest, contrary to conflict of interest rules in some of his stock dealings.
Yeah, I mean, these are the things that are just going to stick around for a while, like you guys said. I mean, I don't know, you know, there's going to be these investigations are going on. It seems like around the country, so we're going to be around for a while.
All right, let's talk about all of the news that's broken this week in Trump land. Much of it has to do with the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, with Russia. I'll tell you what. Let's start with the news that broke last night, which is that Michael Flynn, who, of course, was out on the campaign trail with Donald Trump throughout the summer and fall, was going to be his national security advisor, ended up being fired from the job because he lied to the vice president, if not the president. We know for certain he lied to the vice president, and who, by the way, of course, is caught up in the Sally Yates story, because as acting attorney general, it was Yates who went to the White House and said, you got problems with your national security advisor. FBI knows that he hasn't been telling the truth about his involvement with Russia.
Okay. Right. He was also a representative of the Turkish government.
Yes,
right. while he was working for the Trump campaign.
So the story broke last night that Michael Flynn his attorney has now asked that he be given immunity to testify in this whole Russian investigation, and the attorney's words are he's got a story to tell, which takes us back to Michael Flynn this summer when the Clinton folks were under investigation.
The very last thing that John Podesta just said is no individual too big to jail. That should include people like Hillary Clinton. I mean, five people around her have been given immunity, to include her former chief of staff. When you are given immunity, that means that you've probably committed a crime.
That's Michael Flynn.
Oh, no. Now, Flynn's attorney said that he was only asking for immunity because a witch hunt was going on in Congress.
No.
He didn't.
Well, the president
tweeted that.
The president tweeted that. But, Loretta, what do we make of this development that Michael Flynn has a, quote, story to tell? And what are the implications of it for President Trump?
Well, I'm sure he does have a story to tell. Yeah. I'm sure that part is factual. And I think, you know, by all accounts, this was very premature. And that's one of the questions is, why would they come forward in this manner when they weren't even asked to appear before the intelligence committees? And there's wide ranging. I mean, I'm watching all of these members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, and they, on both sides of the aisle, are choosing their words very carefully around this story. And then there are some former law enforcement, former FBI, you know, former Justice Department people that say, if you've got a story to tell, tell it to us. Tell it to the FBI. Well, that's where you tell your story.
But actually, that may be what happened, because he's not only asking for immunity from the House and Senate investigations, but from the FBI as well.
And that's where it seems to be in limbo. I mean, the New York Times reported that they're not willing, investigators aren't willing yet to give him that immunity until they're further along. So we're going to see how far this investigation goes along. And when they are willing to give him that, then you know they might have something.
Yeah, David, this is interesting, because we first thought, excuse me, that his attorney had asked for what's known as testimonial immunity, which means anything he would say in front of a Senate intelligence committee, would be barred from being used against him in a prosecution. We now, as Greg points out, have learned, no, much broader than that. They've asked justice to give him immunity as well, which does suggest a concern about criminal problems here.
Yeah, I just know I wouldn't want Flynn on lookout while I'm robbing a bank or anything, because he looks like he's ready to roll over pretty quickly. We'll see. We'll see. But it sounds like, you know, another one of those where there's smoke, there's fire instances. And, you know, this is just all circling around the president right now. And Flynn looks like he's making a lot of people nervous.
OK, so the president, I want to go back to that in a second. But I also want to pick up on something you said, Jim. President Trump, on his personal Twitter account at about mid-morning, said this: Mike Flynn should ask for immunity in that this is a witch hunt, excuses for big election loss by media and Dems of historic proportion. So here is the president again, Jim, stepping into a matter that you would think under most circumstances ought to be entirely off limits to him. He, after all, is the subject, we are told by the FBI, of the Russia investigation.
But this is the Trump style. He is setting the plate for a House and Senate investigation by declaring it fake news. This is all a witch hunt. That's the only reason that Mike Flint is asking for immunity, because people are after Mike Flint. You know, he sympathizes with the guy.
All right, so go ahead, Loretta, because I want to ask you a question, but you get in there first.
I think it's in the president's best interest to get this moving along, right? So, you know, it's tarnishing, it's overshadowing his entire agenda. And the quicker that they can get some of these folks that the committee wants to talk to before the committee and move this out of the way. I mean, they've come forward, the FBI directors come forward and say, we have no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. But clearly there's other things being investigated. And the quicker that the White House can facilitate this, get it handled and out of the way, they can move on to the people's business.
So it strikes me, Loretta, just to play, take up the other side of this for a minute. This was a big story that broke last night,
yeah.
And the cable news networks were all over it. But so let me offer a more benign scenario and see what you think of this. Wouldn't you, in a way, isn't the president right? If you're Michael Flynn and you know eventually they're going to come after you, wouldn't you want to get immunity regardless of whether there's anything there or not? David says where there's smoke, there's fire, but there may not be any fire here. We have no idea. So I what I'm suggesting is to draw a conclusion that he's asked for immunity because he knows he's vulnerable to prosecution, maybe entirely incorrect at this point.
Well, I think that is an entirely incorrect assumption to make on anybody's part. You know, Mike Rogers, who is the former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, was speaking on this topic today. And he was asked specifically, when someone has immunity, does that mean that's because they've done something wrong? And he said, no. No, that does not, those two are do not go hand in hand. It does not infer that. There are a lot of reasons that witnesses that come before the committees get immunity. So I think that is just, you know, and every time the president, to your direct question, but every time the president puts this out on Twitter or Facebook, and you know, candidly, sometimes I don't know when it's him tweeting and I don't know when it's his staff tweeting, you know, and there's a whole lot of stories about, you know, who's tweeting in the White House and it's coming out under his name. And so it's not productive to put in this partisanship at this point.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, David. apparently this story is significant enough that here's somebody who's worried about it. The Republican head of the House Oversight Committee, Jason Chaffetz, who has said he finds it, quote, very mysterious why Flynn suddenly wants immunity. He, in response to the Trump tweet, said, I don't think it's a witch hunt. Look, it's very mysterious to me, though, why all of a sudden General Flynn is suddenly out there saying he wants immunity. I don't think Congress should give him immunity. If there's an open investigation by the FBI, that should not happen. I also don't believe that the president should be weighing in on this. They're the ones that actually would prosecute. So you've even got a guy who has protected Republicans routinely in his job as oversight chair. He's weighing in and suggesting this looks bad.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit easier to sort of be more objective to what's going on as you see some of these legislations kind of fail and having this rough, you know, first 60 days for Trump. I think at first people were trying to band together and trying to help him, you know, have a smooth president. But they're kind of seeing that the wheels are coming off. So I think they're trying to, you know, get things in order and try to get with their own home constituency.
I think you are seeing, especially in the House, more bristling of House Republicans at Trump. Just like you said, especially with Trump's attacks on the Freedom Caucus yesterday, you had one Freedom Caucus member after another say, basically, bring it on. I mean, they weren't ducking back. They weren't cowering. They were tweeting right back at Donald Trump, which said a lot.
Well, it took them a while to come back at that, right? They stayed quiet for a little while. And the curious thing about that is that the president is going to need the Freedom Caucus get through tax reform, to get through any immigration reform that he wants. And for those folks that were highly dissatisfied with the Freedom Caucus on the health care bill, and there are a lot of Republicans that were dissatisfied with the Freedom Caucus, the Freedom Caucus had, in essence, begun to isolate itself within the Republican circles. So the president could have held fire, could have gone on to build other coalitions, and they were marginalizing themselves. They were shrinking and marginalizing themselves. And then when he came out, they rallied.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're fighting back.
Right. Basically, Trump threatened to dump the Denny Hastert rule. Which Republicans have respected for how many years? Every year that they've been in power since the late 90s.
Tell our listeners what you're talking about.
Okay, basically that you have Congress governed through the Republican Conference. That if an issue cannot pass without a majority of Republicans, then it's not placed on the floor.
Right. So we're going to watch this unfold. I found it. Interesting to think about how the smoke was building. Talk about smoke, David, in his head. Or last Friday, the health care bill goes up in flames. The Freedom Caucus gets a lot of people blame them. And it's interesting because the president at first, his news conference last week after this, he was very sanguine. He was very thoughtful. It was that side of Trump that we do see sometimes. And then over the weekend, no nasty tweets, no upset. And then midweek this week, suddenly he wakes up and he realizes how angry he is at the Freedom Caucus. And he doesn't just send one tweet. He mentions specific members of the caucus and says, you got to get on board. Raul Labrador is one of Mark Meadows, mm-hmm. So really targeting them. But what the problem is, a president who's well under 40% in approval and who's talking mostly to members who work and live in safe congressional districts, mm-hmm. he doesn't have a whole lot of leverage.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's getting so bad that Paul Ryan is threatening that he might actually work with Democrats, which is like one of the weirdest threats I've heard in political
history.
The president might work on the other side of the rails, like as someone that everybody will rue the day when he does that, which is, I've never really heard that before.
I think that's such a salient point because when you look at last week, I mean, the difference between last week and this week, and last week, you know, Republicans were relieved in a sense that, look, the president's going to the Hill. Obama never went to the Hill mm-hmm. to work legislation. He's going up there multiple times. He's trying to build, you know, consensus around this bill. He's talking to different coalitions of people. He's willing to negotiate. He's working with the speaker. You know, these were all very positive signs. And probably if you polled him last week, he would have had a little bit of a bump. And then you get into this week, and there's all kinds of stories circulating in the media now about, you know, who's driving this in the White House, who's driving this anti-Freedom Caucus narrative. And the president's adopted it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take a few tweets, and then we're going to take a break. We've got tweets from at PoliticsGPB, is by the way where you ought to tweet us. Khalid, going back to our discussion about the legislature, says, glad the Georgia legislature has its priorities in order, guns and yacht bills while our freeways are literally falling apart. Ted Barfield tweets, the Georgia legislature never ceases to disappoint. John Alvey says, interstate broke? Perfect day for the first game at SunTrust Park.
He's right.
So tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we got a lot more to talk about on Political Rewind at 3:49 on Friday afternoon.
For the last 2 years, NPR has followed the journey of one Syrian refugee who risked his life fleeing on raft, by foot, and by train, eventually making his way to Germany. Recently, he got some life-changing good news.
I feel my heart will go out of my chest.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The latest chapter in one refugee's journey this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. And got a little time in our last segment to get to a number of interesting stories that are developed this week. We learned yesterday from the Washington Post, they broke it first, that Devin Nunes when he went up, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, this secret meeting he had on the White House grounds. Apparently he jumped over the fence like a couple of the intruders have and didn't get arrested by the Secret Service. We learn now, Greg, that he was meeting with White House, two named in the Washington Post story, White House aides who gave him the material that he says exonerates Trump on the wiretapping thing. And then he goes back to the White House and gives the material to the President of the United States. A bizarre story that just gets more and more bizarre.
Yeah, there's a reason his committee job is imperiled right now, and that Republicans and Democrats are all questioning whether or not he's the right person to lead that committee.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, you don't have a House Intelligence Committee investigation.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You have a Senate. All the eggs are in the basket of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Okay,
and strategically, those two, the chairman, and the ranking member came out together.
Right,
which was one of the most, you know, it's really, Dave, a bad thing when we get to the point that we're celebrating the fact that a Republican and a Democrat, the chair and the ranking member, came out together to say they're going to pursue an investigation.
No, that was the first time in a long time I felt like we had like a functioning government, just watching two men on a Republican and Democrat in front of microphones, like looking like they can stand each other a little bit, answering questions, seemed to be on the same page. It seemed like we were moving towards the right place for the first time in a while.
So the Senate Intelligence Committee actually had a hearing yesterday, a public hearing. We know that they're going to have some of their hearings in secret, but they did in their joint news conference say we are going to do as much of this out in the plain view of our citizens as we possibly can. And yesterday they had a witness who none of us has ever heard of before. His name is Clint Watts. He is a former FBI agent. He was he's a fellow on national security and Middle East at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's worked on cyber meddling over the years. He's done counterterrorism work. He's got pretty strong academic credentials. And he gave some fairly chilling testimony yesterday that I want to play for you, in which he describes, he's asked why he thinks Russian interference with our elections seems to have stepped up starting when Donald Trump launched his presidential campaign. And here's a little of what he said.
Part of the reason active measures have worked in this U.S. election is because the commander-in-chief has used Russian active measures at time against his opponents. On 11 October, President Trump stood on a stage and cited what appears to be a fake news story from Sputnik News that disappeared from the internet. He claimed that the election could be rigged. That was the number one theme pushed by RT, Sputnik News, white outlets all the way up until the election. But until we get a firm basis on fact and fiction in our own country, get some agreement about the facts, whether it be do I support the intelligence community or a story I read on my Twitter feed, we're going to have a big problem. I can tell you right now today, gray outlets that are Soviet pushing accounts tweet at President Trump during high volumes when they know he's online, and they push conspiracy theories. So if he is to click on one of those or cite one of those, it just proves Putin correct.
So, David, in keeping with what you talked about in terms of bipartisanship, this is a the chairman of this committee is a Republican, and yet this testimony clearly is very troubling in terms of the president of the United States.
Yeah, this is really concerning that we have a president who is so, he's basically like your uncle that comes to Thanksgiving and spouts off things he read on Facebook. I mean, this is ridiculous that you can find these people on Twitter, know when he's tweeting and feed him fake news and know that he's going to retweet. I mean, I know that Fox, you know, he watches Fox News. Fox News knows he watches them, and people on Twitter are repeating and showing when he watches something and puts it on Twitter. I mean, that's scary.
Okay. At the same time, remembering that this committee, like the House committee, if they ever get their act together, is about investigating collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. And as compelling as this testimony by Clint Walls was, it does not say anything about collusion. It says that maybe Trump is vulnerable to odd stories, but we have not yet heard from a single individual who has said there's any real collusion. Right, Galloway?
I think you've had some people at least hint and wonder at it.
Well, wonder for sure. That's what the investigation is about.
And first of all, I would say no. You know, you're not talking about Trump as a participant in a conspiracy. But that clip was scary because it portrayed the president of the United States as a patsy.
Well, I thought it was scary because it tells you just how sophisticated the Russians are, that they identify when they think Trump is available for them to send him a message.
Is he still using an unsecure smartphone?
That's a great question.
Well, apparently this week he changed.
Oh, okay. Really?
There was a story that he changed devices.
Phew.
All right, we've only got
a couple. To have a more secure device.
All right, well, there's going to be a lot more of this story that we'll follow in the weeks ahead. But before we leave, Greg, it didn't take long. In the hours after the legislature went to sine die at 1 a.m. almost, we got our first official candidate for governor of Georgia. Yes.
And so begins the 2018
race. Who is he?
Secretary of State Brian Kemp is formally in the race. He'll have his first campaign stop at the Cobb GOP breakfast tomorrow morning. I'll be there.
And you had a possible Hunter Hill, state senator, one of Casey Cagle's minions in there.
We could have at least half a dozen, if not 8, 9, or 10, legitimate Republican contenders for this race, I think, when it's all said and done. A lot of people think that Casey Cagle, with all his advantages, is still beatable.
And I think it's a reflection of the Donald Trump atmosphere. It has just so roiled the ground here that nobody knows what the rules are anymore. Where's the predictability?
Yeah, we talked about Hunter Hill very briefly on Wednesday, and to go to your point that people feel Casey Cagle is vulnerable. If a member of Casey Cagle's state senate is willing to suggest maybe I'll run,
by the way.
It's going to be more than one.
Yeah, okay. I mean, Josh McCune could get in. Mike Williams could get in.
Gotcha. It'll be fascinating to watch that develop. We also have our first, I think. First identified candidate for Secretary of State. I don't think it's formal yet.
Oh, it's formal.
No.
He just, Buzz Brockway. As we were here, Buzz Brockway said he is definitely in the Secretary of State.
No. R.J. Hadley, if you're listening, he's a Democrat. He's out out on the eastern edge of I-20. We know that you're thinking about it on the Democratic side.
And we've talked on this show about the possibility that we're going to see a governor's race on the Democratic side. The two Stacys, Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams, the minority leader over in the House. So thank goodness we're going to have plenty to talk about on Political Rewind.
And that's just one race.
And that's just one race.
We didn't even talk about the sixth.
Yeah.
We didn't even get to the sixth. I'm sorry we didn't. Next week, we're going to do an entire show on the 6th District race. Next Wednesday, as a matter of fact. So, and of course, we'll talk about it as developments warrant in that race. There's a debate. When's the next debate in that one?
Wednesday, I believe, the Atlanta Press Club.
Yeah.
Okay.
5 o'clock over at the Georgia Pacific Building.
All right. We're out of time for this week's show. Jim Galloway and Greg Bluestein, thank you for being with us. I was really worried. You were up so late. I thought you'd be home napping. But thank you for helping us understand what happened in the final hours of the legislature, as well as all the other contributions you make. David Dennis, great to have you here. Thanks.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for coming in. And Loretta Lepore, we always love having you here. So,
well, thank you.
I hope you all have a great weekend. Keep the conversation going on Twitter at PoliticsGPB. We read your tweets, even when the show's not on the air. I really enjoy seeing them. So please keep tweeting us. Remember that within the next hour or so, if you go to AJC Political Insider, Greg or Jim are going to post today's audio. So if you want to relive the wonderful moments from today's show, it'll be at Political Insider on AJC.com. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll be back with you on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Until then, have a great weekend.